Science is more exciting today than when I was your age because there's so many things being discovered. And may I say, there's so much good material that relates to believing in God. When I was in college, struggling with some of these same issues about which I will be speaking, there was very little material published that was worth reading from the creationist viewpoint. Now there's a massive amount of it. That's exciting to me, and I hope it is to you, because I truly believe that we live in a time when we can magnify God more easily than ever. So I say that at the beginning, and I will say it several times during the course of this series. Second thing I want to say to you is, I do these kinds of lectures often in science classrooms, either on a college campus or a high school campus. In those settings, I do not make reference to the Bible at all. When I do it in a church building, I like to start with a scripture. So we will do that tonight. But I want you to understand from the beginning that the focus of this series is God's other book. I believe this is God's book. And I have a great delight teaching lessons from this book. But this series is teaching lessons from God's other book, which I'm convinced He has also provided for us with tremendous amount of information that can convict us who He is. So understand, I don't want anybody offended when we in a church building don't spend a great deal of time in this book. Please don't be offended by that, because I'm convinced the testimony we're about to speak of is powerfully testimonial of God in a different book that God has also provided. So with that beginning, let me introduce this topic tonight this way. I want to begin answering this question as many scientists in our age would answer it. Is it reasonable to believe in God in this scientific age? The answer many would give is absolutely not, given all that we've learned about the natural world. There is no reason, many would say, for you to believe in God. In fact, it's antiquated, and some would even say dangerous, like Richard Dawkins, who wrote the book, The Blind Watchmaker, The God Delusion, and would say to you tonight, if he were here, that those who are believers in God are really not effective for society. In fact, they're dangerous. So is it reasonable to believe in God in the scientific age? There are many, many people that would say, absolutely not. Get over it. So, for example, in the beginning of this book, Dawkins refers to a book that was written in the 1800s by William Paley. William Paley was a natural theologian, and he wrote this book to show that there's good reason to believe in God. And if you went to college in the early 1800s in England, you would have taken William Paley's course in natural theology. The title of the book is Evidences of the Existence and Attributes of the Deity Collected from the Appearances of Nature. And so the whole book was about why you should believe in God from the evidence of nature. And one of his grand arguments was, if you were walking along a heath in England and you came across a rock, you would probably not be surprised at the least by that and say, isn't that interesting? It's been here a long time, and move right on. But if you kicked over that rock and found a watch, a functioning watch, that'd be a different matter. And he makes the point that just as a watch is organized and designed to do certain things, so many things in the natural world have that same appearance of being designed. And his whole argument was the argument from design. Now here's what Mr. Dawkins says about that. Paley drives his point home with beautiful and reverent descriptions of the dissected machinery of life. His argument is made with passionate sincerity and is informed by the best biological scholarship of his day. But it is wrong. Gloriously and utterly wrong. The analogy between the telescope and an eye, between the watch and a living organism, is false. The appearance, all appearances to the contrary, the only watchmaker in nature is the blind forces of physics. Albeit deployed in a very special way. A true watchmaker has foresight. He designs his cogs and springs, plans their interconnections with a future purpose in his mind's eye. Natural selection, the blind, unconscious, automatic process which Darwin discovered and which we now know is the explanation for all apparent purposeful forms, has no purpose. It has no mind. It has no mind's eye. It does not plan for the future. It has no vision. It has no foresight. It has no sight at all. In fact, if it can play the role of a watchmaker in nature, it is called the blind watchmaker. And then he proceeds to take 300 pages to explain to you why he believes everything you observe in nature, including you, were produced by the blind forces of physics acted upon by natural selection. I have not seen such faith in all of Israel. But that is his faith, as it is of many in our age. Here's what the Bible says in Romans chapter 1 and verse 20. This is not the basis for my discussion tonight. But for all in this audience who believe the Bible is the Word of God, as do I want to show you that the Bible itself teaches that the argumentation I'm going to use is biblical. Verse 20 says in Romans chapter 1, let's go back to verse 19. For what can be known about God is plain because God has shown it to them. His invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made so that they are without excuse. That passage claims that you can see the invisible God. And how do you do that? You see it through the things that he made. They testify of his existence. And in particular, his eternal power, whoever this God is, he must be magnificently powerful. And his divine nature, which says he is not part of this natural world, separate. Those things we can learn by examining the things that are made. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the argument from design. And it will be the basis for my entire series this weekend. I'm speaking to you about design, which I've believed is always the strongest argument for the existence of God by examining the natural world. And I hope by the time we finish, ladies and gentlemen, you will be overwhelmed with the magnificence of God because of our examination of the natural world. So tonight's lesson begins with this very famous picture. Anybody know what that's a picture of? this is the earth over here. And what's this? That's the moon. How many of you were alive in 1968? Raise your hand. Thank you for making me feel better. This whole bunch up here doesn't even know what 1968 is. There were lots of people alive in 1968. This picture, ladies and gentlemen, was taken on the night, well, it wasn't taken that exact same night, but it was taken in December of 1968. And it has come to have the wonderful title of the Earth Rise, because it was seen as the astronauts came around the dark side of the moon and saw this amazing gleaming object for the first time. So they saw Earth rise. And it's become one of the most famous pictures ever made. Now, this is a sidelight. It's not part of my lesson. I own that picture. Not exactly. I have the original printed copy of that picture, which was rejected by NASA because they said it's not blue enough in the print that was made. Do you kids know they used to have to print photographs? They would take the film and put it in stuff and print it out on a piece of paper. Now you just click 1,000 times. I have the original photograph print of that picture. If you want to know more about that, ask me later. It's a treasure. And it's an interesting story. Now let me read you just a little bit from a good book I want to recommend to you, The Privileged Planet by Guillermo Gonzalez and Jay Richards. On Christmas Eve, 1968, the Apollo 8 astronauts, I should ask you old folks if you know who that was, Frank Borman, James Lovell, and William Anders, remember? Three men became the first human beings to see the far side of the moon. The moment was as historic as it was perilous. They had been wrested from Earth's gravity and hurled into space by the massive, barely tested Saturn V rocket. Although one of their primary tasks was to take pictures of the moon and search for future landing sites. You remember this, old people? The first lunar landing would take place 7 months later in 1969, kids. We stepped on the moon. But many associate their mission with a different photograph, commonly known as Earthrise. Emerging from the moon's far side during their fourth orbit, the astronauts were suddenly transfixed by their vision of Earth, a delicate, gleaming swirl of blue and white, contrasting with the monochromatic, barren lunar horizon. Earth had never appeared so small to human eyes, and yet was never more the center of attention. To mark the event's significance and its occurrence on Christmas Eve, the crew had decided after much deliberation to read the following. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The reading and the reverent silence that followed went out over a live telecast to an estimated 1 billion viewers, the largest single audience in television history. How many of you were watching that night? It was amazing. Wonder what would happen today if an astronaut tried to read Genesis 1:1 on the public airways. I think he'd be crucified. But I'm thankful for the very first time that Earth was seen like this. That's what they read. Now, the fact is that Frank Borman and James Lovell, after this experience, became deeper believers in God than they had been before. William Anders, on the other hand, became a greater skeptic and became a vociferous opponent to those who believed in God, said he found no evidence of God out there. I don't see God out here. And there have been plenty of cosmonauts who've said the same. Which only illustrates, class, that the same set of evidence can have completely different reactions. And there are a host of factors that affect that. Part of which is our own backgrounds, our tendencies to see things the way we choose to see them, our prejudices. I would ask you in this series if you would open your mind. And if there are those here this evening who are not certain about your convictions about God, and there are lots of folks with that, and please say, understand, I'm so thankful you're here and listening. Or maybe you're going to listen to this recording. Allow yourself to open your mind sufficiently to at least examine the evidence without prejudice. And you remember, I read in this book by Dawkins that Paley presented his case with passionate sincerity, and he goes on to say, I'm going to be passionate too, because I believe what I believe. So if I get a little loud and passionate, I'm joining good company. And I do, by the way, because I believe firmly that the evidence is overwhelming. And you certainly get enough of the other side of this issue on all television programs and everywhere you look. So design at the macroscopic level. I say this shows design. I'm going to show you why. But there's plenty of folks that don't see design there. They see a natural phenomenon that just happened. There's no evidence of God there. In 1977, we sent a spacecraft into space called Voyager 1. How many were alive then? You remember Voyager 1? That wasn't as famous as these others, but it was pretty impressive because the object of Voyager 1 was to send a spacecraft out to look at Jupiter and Saturn and their moons and then just keep going. And if you go today, and don't you dare do it right now, I'm talking, and click in your telephones on Voyager 1, you'll find out it's still out there on March the 12th, 2020. 47 years later, it's still going and still sending messages to us. It's incredible. Well, you see up here? No, you don't see because it's too light. So, thank you. And let's keep it that way for just a minute. Do you see here? Here's the Earth around the sun, and here are lots of orbits of the planets, and here's the path that followed, that went past Jupiter and Saturn, and then just kept going. And it continues to go into deep space. And at one point in its mission in 1990, about 13 years after it took off, Carl Sagan talked the NASA community into having it turn around and take a picture of our solar system from 4 billion miles away. And it took pictures of every planet in our solar system. It was amazing. And there's one of them. I don't know how well you can see this. There's a dot right there. This was not in the picture, people. That is an imposed arrow that was put on there later. And you see that kind of band of light there? That will be commented on in a moment. But that little pale blue dot has become the subject of a book by Carl Sagan. Let's see if I can find my thingy here. It's called, believe it or not, The Pale Blue Dot by Carl Sagan. Let there be light. There you go. This is a quote from The Pale Blue Dot. Because of the reflection of sunlight, Earth seems to be sitting in a beam of light, but it's just an accident of geometry and optics. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe, are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in a great enveloping cosmic dark. In all our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves, says Carl Sagan. He's a scientist, but he's a good writer too. Are you sufficiently depressed? I will tell you that scientists who do not believe in God would say to you, why would you think some little speck like that has the interest of some God somewhere? We're in the midst of nothingness. Get over thinking there's someone coming to save you. And he talks in that book about how many millions of gallons of blood have been shed by the cruelty of people here on this earth. Many of them thinking they believe in a God. And it's horrendous. But Carl Sagan was one of the most famous popularizers of science. His Cosmos series was the most watched science series ever. You kids know the Cosmos series? Before you were born. Carl Sagan has passed from this life. I have an idea he knows a whole lot more today than he knew then. But he was very influential. And the reason I do this series, ladies and gentlemen, and young people especially, is because I've been your age, believe it or not. And I went through a period of time where I was deeply challenged by intelligent people who were telling me, you believers in God better get over it, because the more we learn about the natural world, the less we need any God of any kind. And it was deeply disturbing. And I did not have anybody come into my life and do a series like this. I wish they had. So it's been a passion of my life for 50 years now. And I want to share with you some of the things I've learned. So in the 1960s, when all of this was happening, and in the early 70s, it was an exciting time. Look, our world was changing. We were uncovering all kinds of new things. And one of my required readings at Harvard University when I went there as a master's degree student was Intelligent Life in the Universe by I.S. Schlafsky, and guess who? Carl Sagan. Required reading. And the whole thesis of this book is that evolution has clearly taken place here, and it must have taken place lots of other places as well. And as we uncover the secrets of the universe, surely we're going to find lots of other intelligent civilizations in many places on Earth. And thus blossomed a movement called SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And out of that came a whole bunch of series about space stuff, didn't it? Now, kids, you know about this. Did y'all see E.T.? Okay, I'm getting into their time frame. What does ET stand for? Extraterrestrial. The thesis of this book class was, what are the chances of finding an intelligent civilization somewhere else in the universe? And I can tell you, they were very excited in the late 60s that there were lots and lots of intelligent civilizations in just our own Milky Way galaxy. Probably millions of them. And there's lots of information in here about how we'd find out about that. What kind of stuff we'd look for. One of the big things was radio signals. And my professor in astronomy at Harvard that year was a part of a worldwide group, a network of people looking for signs of intelligence in the universe. It was the beginning of SETI, S-E-T-I, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And I'll not tell you a whole lot more about that tonight, but this book is full of reasons why you should believe there are lots of other civilizations that came about by natural causes, just like it did here, they say. And one of the early efforts of trying to figure out how many there were was the Frank Drake equation, which I show you here on the board. And we're not going to go over it in detail, but I will tell you that they're trying to find out, N here is the number of communicating civilizations in our galaxy right now. So how in the world are you going to find that out? Well, you start with the number of stars in the galaxies, which is about 200 billion in this one galaxy. And then the fraction of those stars suitable for life, 0.05 to 0.3. Well, that's a pure guess, ladies and gentlemen. And the fraction of suitable stars with planets. I mean, there's some physics behind that one. And the average number of habitable planets or moons per solar system. Which ones are habitable? You think every planet around any star is habitable? We know good and well it isn't. And then the fraction of these on which life develops. Well, who on earth knows that? It's a guess. And so on down the line. And out of that, he comes up with a number, this N, somewhere between 0.6 zeros and a 5 and 750,000. That's pretty close. Zero to 750,000, basically. And I'll tell you what Carl Sagan did with that, and Frank Drake and a whole bunch of others. It's more likely it's way up here somewhere. So those were the early beginnings of trying to figure out about other civilizations somewhere. I like to use that illustration because what are you looking for, ladies and gentlemen? You're looking for signs of intelligent design. Are you listening to me? How would you go about searching for signs of intelligent design in the universe? Here's how you do it. You're looking for things you know nature cannot do by itself, and that have in them information that must have been produced by something intelligent. Are you with me, class? Sometimes people just glaze over, and I don't allow that. Well, there's Drake's equation. A bunch of guessing that led to an awful lot of expenditure. Did you know your tax money paid for SETI for 25 years? And after 25 years of finding exactly nothing, they stopped using your tax money. But they're still looking today. Fast forward, we were in the 1960s, you remember? Fast forward almost 50 years, right? To 2004. And here's a very interesting book that came out that year, by Peter Ward and Donald Brownlee. And the subtitle up here on this book is, Maybe We Are Alone in the Universe After All. Now that is not written by Bible believers. That's written by two evolutionists who absolutely believe life here on earth came about by natural causes. But they've examined the universe and its properties. And in 2004, they dared to write a book that was the exact opposite of what Carl Sagan said. It may be the Earth is very rare. And Mitch, that's what Rare Earth's about. That's where I got the title. And I love that title because that is not what folks were saying in the 1960s and 70s when I was your age. Now we're beginning to learn so much about our universe that the idea that there's another civilization at even the level of this one is practically zero. By the same people. No, it's their descendants. Why complex life is uncommon in the universe. Now look, to be fair to them, they don't believe that little one-celled organisms or little life like that may be, they might be, that may be fairly common. But complex life like us, and with whom we might communicate, maybe we're the only people in the universe. That's a pretty big statement, folks. Then here's another interesting book that I've already introduced to you, The Privileged Planet, and their thesis is this: how our place in the universe is designed for discovery. The very same rare properties that allow for our existence, listen, class, the very same rare properties that allow for our existence. I'm going to talk to you about that, and if you don't remember one thing except what I just said tonight, you remember that. The very fact that you are here, ladies and gentlemen, and living is one of the greatest miracles ever. How are there living human beings? Guillermo Gonzalez and Jay Richards say the properties that allow us to exist are very rare. But those same properties also provide the best overall setting to make discoveries about the world around us. Their point is, the same properties that allow us to be here allow us to make the optimum observations of our universe. That's the thesis of that book. And it's fascinating. There's some heavy science in there, but you can skip that and get the essence of the story. So thus does our inquiry reduce to a single question. Is it possible that this immense symphonic system of atoms, fields, forces, stars, galaxies, and people is the result of a choice, a purpose, an intention, rather than simply some inscrutable outworking of the blind necessity or an inexplicable accident? I think that's a good question. If so, then it's surely possible that there could be evidence to suggest such a thing. And so they end this treatise that we're missing a signal that reveals a universe so skillfully crafted for life and discovery that it seems to whisper of an extraterrestrial intelligence immeasurably more vast, more ancient, and more magnificent than anything we've been willing to expect or imagine. Almost as good as Sagan. The conclusion of their study is, ladies and gentlemen, it may just be we've missed the whole signal of the universe, that it was designed. And may I tell you, and sadness, that Guillermo Gonzalez, an astronomer at Iowa State University, has yet to get tenure as he dared to make such a statement. Because in scientific communities and colleges and universities these days, someone who allows himself to be revealed, to have some notion of belief in God, is a pariah. And then here's another excellent work, I think. And it's written at a level that's a little lower than some of these heavy science books. And it's written by a policeman. His name is J. Warner Wallace. His daddy was a policeman. His son is a policeman. They were detectives. And so he wrote this book as a cold case detective examining the evidence of the divinely created universe. Because this man became a believer from his examination of the evidence, when he was a total atheist, as his daddy is to this day. It's a wonderful book. I highly recommend it. Young people, you need to get this one. So I want to start this way. I want to play you a little snippet of a video of this man introducing his own book. And then I'm going to use it as my stepping stone for the rest of my lesson. So, you are blessed to have a sharp techie guy. And I am totally dependent. Let's roll it.
This book, God's Crime Scene, is actually an attempt to kind of interest people in the case for God's existence using principles of cold case investigations or of homicide investigations, because I think a lot of these things are transferable. This is a discipline that's transferable. As an example, typically when you walk into a death scene, not every death scene is a crime scene, because there are four ways to die, and only one of those is criminal. You could die by natural causes, accidentally, by way of suicide, or by homicide. So the first goal I have to do is to determine which of these four is most reasonable given the evidence in the room. And sometimes one of the simplest ways to do that is to take an approach that it's a little game I call inside or outside the room. Because if you can explain all the evidence inside the room by staying inside the room, there's a good chance this is not a homicide. For example, if I've got an injury, a gunshot injury, and there's a pistol in the room, but the doors are all locked and there's no evidence of an intruder and all the fingerprints in the room come back to the victim and it's even the victim's gun registered to him, well, I can explain everything in the room by staying inside the room. That's going to be a suicide. And it could look kind of crazy, but it's still going to be a suicide, regardless of how it looks, because there's no evidence that I have to explain by going outside the room. If, on the other hand, I've got something in the room that I can't explain by staying in the room, I have to go outside for an explanation. Maybe that gun is not registered to him, and there's unknown fingerprints on the gun, or there's bloody footprints leading out of the house. Well, now I've got to go out of the room to get an explanation for what's inside the room. Now I've got to consider the real possibility of an intruder. That changes everything. I thought, well, could we take the same approach and apply it not just to a death scene, but apply it to the entire known natural universe and ask this question: can we explain everything inside the universe by staying inside the room? If we can, then naturalism is sufficient. There's no reason to think we have an intruder. On the other hand, if we have to go outside the natural universe to explain this stuff that we see inside the room of the natural universe, that changes everything, because now we've got good reason to believe we've got an intruder. Of course, if we had that kind of an intruder, we'd have to consider the kind of cosmic nature of this, the divine nature of this kind of an intruder, at least the supra, extra, supernatural quality or nature of this kind of an intruder. And that's really the premise of God's Crime Scene. We're going to examine eight pieces of evidence in the universe and ask the question, can we explain these things and account for these things by staying inside the room?
Now, wasn't that clear? And by the way, there are lots of videos out there of him telling his own case, so. But I like the book because it's clearly explained, it's very simply explained, and it deals with powerful lines of evidence. So, he said there are eight qualities or things inside the room of the universe that he's going to deal with in this book. Set your mind at ease. I'm not dealing with all eight of them. But I do want to point them out to you. The universe appears to have a beginning right here. That's a whole subject in its own. Fascinating. Did you know we didn't used to believe that? Atheists didn't used to believe that. Now, practically everybody believes the universe had a beginning. That's hard for an evolutionist, folks. Second, the universe appears fine-tuned. That's the one I'm going to talk about tonight. Third, life originated from non-life, if that's what happened on their part. Biological organisms display attributes and design. That's tomorrow and a part of Sunday. Evil and injustice persist. Transcendent objective moral truths exist. Humans possess free agency and consciousness exists. Those are characteristics of our universe, according to him. And he deals with every one of them and shows why you need to go outside the room to explain what's inside. And it's beautifully done, I think. You read it and challenge it. So what's the evidence in the room? I'm looking at one piece of that evidence. The universe appears, ladies and gentlemen, to be supremely fine-tuned for us to exist. I want to give you just a taste of that. So please, do not fall asleep. And if I see you, I'm going to make you stand up, because I don't allow sleeping. This is too important. So, class, chapter 2. Every chapter in this book starts with a a court case that he as a detective dealt with. Every chapter. So this chapter on fine-tuning starts with this one. Are you listening? Helen knew something was wrong when her daughter Carrie failed to answer the door. It was a bright summer afternoon. Carrie said she'd be home, and her car was indeed parked in the driveway. Helen tried to peek in through the living room window, but the curtains were unusually drawn. Carrie never locked the back door, but when Helen walked around to the backyard of the old home, she found the door locked and all the windows closed. This wasn't like Carrie. She usually left one badly worn rear window slightly ajar. Not this time. Helen began to panic. She knew Todd and Carrie had a tumultuous marriage, one that included physical violence. Todd had moved out, but Helen still feared for her daughters and her safety. The couple had a child named Lexi, but the violence had only intensified since her birth. A week ago, Todd had threatened to kill Carrie, and just last night, Carrie confided, there had been another fight. When Helen couldn't get Carrie to answer the door this afternoon, she decided to call the police. I'm going to skip the reading here, but they started examining the evidence. He calls them foundational. Let me just put that up here. Foundational evidence, that's background stuff. And then he talks about regional evidence. That's evidence in the vicinity. And then he talks about locational evidence. And every cold case detective goes at it this way. So now he wants to apply those principles to examining the origin of the universe. So let me just share a little bit with you about what happened. Both Carrie and Lexi were in perfect health the night they died. Was their death inevitable? And by the way, I didn't tell you they died. They finally got in and found them dead. And the question was, how'd they die? Can you explain this by all the evidence inside the room? Or do you look for something outside? Were the circumstances such that nothing could have been done to change the outcome? Clearly, if circumstances had been just slightly different, never would they have died that night. If the pilot light had been lit or the gas turned off, and there hadn't been clothing blocking the airway at the bottom of the bedroom door, or the pocket door at the bottom of the stairs had been open, or the windows had been ajar, the outcome might have been different. In a sense, the regional circumstances related to conditions of the house and the local to the circumstances in the bedroom. And the heater seemed contrived, and especially, by the way, they found out that Todd had ordered the gas turned on 2 days before, which had been turned off for years. I will tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that based on the foundational, regional, and locational evidence in this case, Todd was convicted of first-degree murder. This was not a natural event. It was not suicide, and it was not an accident. It was a planned murder. And the conclusion was based on the summary of the evidence. We were compelled to examine the evidence of tampering because one important fact was there. There were dead bodies. And it was a crime scene based on the summary of those evidences. In a similar way, ladies and gentlemen, when we look at nature, at our universe, the existence of living bodies ought to provoke an investigation. How in the world did this happen? Like our murder scene, there are foundational, regional, and locational conditions demanding explanation. The foundational laws of physics, the regional properties of our solar system, and the locational conditions of our planet resulted in life on Earth. Did that happen within the universe? Or was there an intruder? That's the question. The just-so appearance of fine-tuning in our universe is rather uncontroversial. You see, if this were a court case, ladies and gentlemen, I would bring up witnesses for my opposition, and they would say the same thing as the witnesses for me. Because even the believers in evolution cannot deny this. The Goldilocks enigma. Why is the universe just right for life? Kids, you know why they would call that the Goldilocks enigma? You remember the story, right? Goldilocks went out to the woods, found a house, right? Whose house was it? The three bears. Mama bear, daddy bear, and baby bear. So she went inside the house, and the first thing she found was what, class? Bowls of porridge on the table. They'd gone out for a walk, you remember, while the porridge cooled down. So she tried the first daddy's bowl, and it was? She tried mama's bowl, and it was? And then she tried baby's bowl, and it was? Just right. That's why they call this that. Because class, everywhere you look in the universe, things are just right to allow you to be here. Everywhere you look. Now look, if this were a court case, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I would say to you, there are coincidences. I get that. Things happen. But how many coincidences can you put up with before you say, there was an intruder here? And I'm going to tell you, because I don't have time to talk about the many, many, many ones there are. There are so many, you would be an absolute, I was going to say ignoramus, if you didn't see it. This didn't happen by natural causes. One of the most significant facts, arguably the most significant fact about the universe, is that we are a part of it. How'd that happen? Dawkins says there is no problem with that. Blind forces of physics acting by natural selection, acting upon matter, produced you over millions of years. No problem. It was the blind watchmaker. Dawkins might have been forgiven 50 years ago. Not anymore. Everyone agrees the universe looks as if it was designed for life. You say that, see that word right there? And here's what an evolutionist does. It looks as if our universe is spectacularly fine-tuned for life. By this I mean only that it looks as if small changes in this universe's basic features would have made life's evolution impossible. The facts are, ladies and gentlemen, there are hundreds and hundreds of these. That a tiny change in any of them, you would not be here. And everybody knows it. So we have what's called the anthropic principle. You know from scriptures the word anthropos is the Greek word for, anybody know? Human beings. So the anthropic principle is the human principle. And it's a scientific principle. In the 1960s, scientists had discovered two characteristics of the cosmos they considered fine-tuned to make physical life possible. Two, when I was in school. At the same time, they had found 8 to 10 characteristics of our solar system that were fine-tuned to make human life possible. So maybe there could be 10 coincidences. I think, you know, that falls within at least the realm of possibilities. But we've done a lot more studying and discovering since the 1960s, class. By the 2000s, scientists had discovered 38 characteristics of the cosmos recognized as fine-tuned for physical life. And I don't mean recognized by creationists. I mean recognized by well-respected scientists in the field. and over 150 characteristics of our solar system fine-tuned for human life to be possible. We're now looking, ladies and gentlemen, at 188 coincidences. How many does it take for you before you get off and say, no, there was an intruder here? Doesn't take that many for me. So what are some of these? Let's look at foundational fine-tuned factors that support life. These are properties of the universe that we have discovered. Clearly, these are pretty heavy reading. And in his book, this might be a part you might need to skip a little bit of, because it's pretty heavy stuff. But the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, the electromagnetic force, you know, this is electrons and protons attracting each other, and that, there are things related to that. The gravitational force, y'all have all heard of that, of course. You know that if you drop something, it's going to fall. Objects with mass attract one another. They fall toward one another. We call that gravity. That's a property we've learned about. And by the way, did you know that if the property of gravitational force changed only a minuscule amount, you wouldn't be here? That's the truth. The ratio of electrons to protons. Now, you may not think about that too often in your sleep. That's a very important property of the universe. And let me just read you about that one. The ratio of electrons to protons, both in their numbers and in their mass, must be precariously balanced. If the value of this ratio, that's the number of protons versus the number of electrons, deviated by more than one part in 10 to the 37th power, the universe as we know it would not exist. Don't believe me about that. You go look this up for yourself. This is a well-established fact, ladies and gentlemen, property of the universe. Well, 1 in 10 to the 37th, that doesn't mean anything to you. So he gives an example in his book to try to give you a clue of how massive that number is and how small the deviation has to be. Okay? Are you ready? This is math. Imagine covering the entire North American continent in dimes and stacking them till they reach the moon. Now imagine stacking just that many dimes again on another billion continents the same size as North America. So you have 1 billion in one continent stacked with dimes to the moon. If you marked one of those dimes and hid it in the billions of piles you'd assembled, the odds of a blindfolded friend picking out the correct dime is approximately 1 out of 10 to the 37th. The same level of precision required in the ratio of electrons to protons. So may I put it this way? Everybody look at me. If you stretch something from here to here, and that represents that ratio, if you change that stretch from here to here, one little teensy piece of that, you wouldn't be here. That is 8 of them, right? 2, 4, 2, 4, that's 6 of them. There are 38 just like it. Foundational properties of the universe. You change them one teensy bit and you would not be here. Again, do not believe me, class. I want to say that again. You challenge what I'm saying and you challenge what other scientists tell you too. Don't you just swallow what they're telling you. I'm telling you, the scientific community agrees on this, and they still believe it happened by natural causes. Some folks have more faith than I do. Foundational fine-tuned factors. That's like in the court case, Todd has threatened to kill his wife, and they had a horrible relationship, and they just had a fight last night. Isn't that pretty good foundational evidence that he killed her? It's background. And how about regional? We're talking now about our galaxy. There are lots of galaxies in the universe, folks. We know that. We've taken pictures of them. Well, the Hubble telescope, which came along in your lifetime, didn't it, kids? Hubble? It's out there going around our planet, taking lots of pictures you can't take from Earth because there's too much atmosphere in the way, right? If you have not gone to your website and looked up pictures from the Hubble telescope, you need to go do that. It's incredible. So, I want to show you one picture taken by Hubble, and I want the lights off again. Because there's too much light in Phoenix for you to really appreciate what's out there. This is a Hubble telescope picture of the constellation Serpens. Folks, that is one tiny piece of the sky out there. And look at all of this magnificence. You see all these? And you think, look at all those thousands of stars. No, ladies and gentlemen, that, and a bunch of these are not stars. They are galaxies that themselves contain billions of stars. And this is one small portion of the universe. There are thousands and millions and billions. Well, surely among all of those, you can find intelligent life forms because it developed here by natural causes. Surely it happened somewhere else. That's the argument. Well, here's one of the problems with our regional case. You can turn the lights back on now if you would. There are all kinds of galaxies out there, but 95% of them, class, are either elliptical or irregular. And did you hear what I just said? 95% of all those galaxies are either elliptical or irregular. That's not my number. Elliptical and irregular galaxies are highly unlikely to contain a solar system like ours that has planets that has life on it. In fact, scientists would tell you these are not candidates for looking for extraterrestrial intelligence. This kind is. It just so happens, class, that our Milky Way galaxy is one of these, not the others. And of course, what an evolutionist would say to you, well, of course, this is the kind of galaxy that can support life because that's where it happened, right? Just that's the coincidence, that's where it happened. These others couldn't do that, so therefore. But what I'm telling you is, most of the galaxies in the universe are out! There aren't a lot of these. So we're down to reducing the number of possibilities, aren't we? We're moving toward this. Okay? And I'm just getting started. So now you've eliminated at least 95% of all the galaxies in the universe. But having a right galaxy is not enough, class. There are a whole lot of other features that are, what's the word? Just, say it, right. Our galaxy is just right, but not all of it. You have to be at the right place in the galaxy. So here's a picture of our galaxy sideways. It has a big old bulb in the middle. Look, if there were a planetary system inside there, you know what happened to it? Watch. It would last about 3 seconds. You can't have a solar system like ours in here. In fact, in this entire system, there's two little donuts right there and right there where it could happen. You've eliminated 95% of the Milky Way galaxy for supporting life. Are you with me? Nod your head or something. Okay. But you can't just have the right place in the galaxy. You've got to have the right kind of star. Did you know our star is just, the answer is just right. Did you know our star is? It is. Let me show you. These are mock-ups, you know. That's not a real picture. But if that were the size of our sun, here's Jupiter, here's whatever, Neptune, I guess, and here's Earth. Look at Earth down here. And here's Pluto. By the way, Pluto's back as a planet. Did you know that? you can be encouraged. I do a whole lesson on Pluto. It's fascinating. We just sent a spaceship to Pluto. You know that. Called the New Horizon. Go look it up. All right, that's not my point of right here. Look at the comparison of our planets to the sun. You know, that's pretty important. But our sun needs to be the right, just right. Our sun, ladies and gentlemen, is a pretty big object. But when you compare it to Sirius, the dog star, and Pollux, and Arcturus, look at our sun. And I'm not done. Look. Here's Arcturus that was on that last one. Here's Rigel and Aldebaran and Betelgeuse and Antares. Where's the sun? Right there. It's one pixel in that picture. You can't even see it. You know, class, our sun is approximately in the middle of all stars. It is just right. Now, that's the case. Okay, so there's another coincidence. Of course it had to be that way in order for life to exist, so that's another coincidence. That the sun, our sun, is just right. And may I say to you, I'm skipping about 30 pages here of other things about our sun that are just right. It's not just the size. It's a bunch of stuff. All of which, if you change them within a very finely tuned amount, you wouldn't be here. So how'd you get here? It was just a coincidence, class. It's just the blind forces of fixed physics acting upon natural selection. You also have to have the proper mass of your planet. We're talking about regional fine-tuned factors here. This would be like the clothes stuffed under the door blocking the gas. It has to be the right proper mass within a very narrow limit, folks. So here's our planets again. Do you think, class, that Jupiter could support life? If you do, you need to think again. It's way too massive. Its gravitational force would destroy any living thing in microseconds. And there's a whole lot of other reasons. You would not want to live there. How about Uranus and Neptune and Saturn? No, folks. How many of our planets around our sun do you think are in the habitable zone of being the right mass? Tell me. Earth, Mars, and Venus. What's that one? Mercury and Pluto. So out of our nine, and that 9, 2, 4, 6, 8, 9, yeah, Pluto's still in. These three are the only ones in the mass range of our three. Is anybody looking for life on Venus? Where are they looking for it? On Mars. You know why? Venus's atmosphere is mostly sulfuric acid. And there's all kinds of other problems with Venus. Nobody's looking on Venus for life forms. They are looking on Mars, and they get all excited because they find some vague evidence that there might have been water sometime. But I would say to you, two out of our nine are all you can even think about. That eliminates all the rest of them. It also has to have just the right spin and just the right tilt. I'm skipping forward here because I can see you're wearing out on me. You learned about this in junior high school, didn't you? The Earth is tilted, did you know that, to the perpendicular axis? The tilt is 23 and a half degrees. You need to go home and thank God for 23 and a half degrees. That is hugely important to allow this Earth to have life on it. Anybody want to give me one reason? There's about 15 or 20. Climate. It helps regulate climate. Up here in the northern part, we have, let's see, we have summer in one season and they have winter, right? And then when you're in a different place, they have winter and you have summer, or they have summer and you have winter. It's vice versa. Did you know one of the big factors about that tilt as the Earth goes around is the distribution of energy across the Earth? That's a fascinating chapter. By the way, I forgot another book here, The Source, by another former atheist, John Clayton. He has a chapter on each one of these things. Fascinating. Go read it. We have to have the just right moon. I'm not going to take time on that one, but my, is that a fantastic subject. It's not just for lovers to stand out there and kiss. The moon does all kinds of things that supports life. And it's just right, class. You have to have just the right atmospheric conditions. You have to have just the right terrestrial crust on the earth. And 140 more, which I don't have time to talk about. And it's okay to yell. 3 exclamation points. So, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I would say to you, given the evidence that we now know of 180 at least qualities that are foundational, regional, and locational, all of which have to fall within a narrow range of fine-tuning or to be... How do you explain that? How would you explain it, ladies and gentlemen of the jury? Would you say with Dawkins, anything that appears to have design doesn't, because it was a blind watchmaker that did all of this? Yeah. And Carrie and her daughter Lexi just happened to die of asphyxiation with all the evidence supporting murder. And I close with this, ladies and gentlemen. If you were in my chemistry class, which I don't teach anymore, but I really miss it, we would spend about 6 weeks on this one substance. It is the most fascinating, incredible, amazing substance in the universe. What are they looking for on Mars? Water. No water, no life. And there is no substitute. When I teach water in chemistry, we do experiments and we look at the properties of water compared to every other common substance we can have time to do, you know. And it compares as a unique substance every time. And by the way, there's no such thing as very unique. Don't say that. That's wrong. It's either unique or it isn't. Don't say this is more unique than that. There's no such thing. Unique means there's one of a kind. It covers more than 70% of the Earth's surface, and they're trying to find some evidence of some dusty stuff that might be on Mars. It's everywhere, isn't it? Most plants and animals are 60% water by volume. So kids, if your sister calls you waterhead, she's right. But you can call her that too. How about watermelon? What percent water do you think that one is? About 98%, and boy, is it good. It's mostly water, but it's a big old hunk of thing. You try to lift one of those things, but it's mostly water. The thing that makes water unique in one way is its structure, and everybody knows water is H2O, so there's two hydrogens and one oxygen. What you probably don't know is the arrangement of those atoms in the molecule that is absolutely critical. There's a bond angle of 104.5 degrees here that allows this end of the molecule to be slightly positive, this end slightly negative. It's called a polar molecule, and it is one of the most polar of common substances, which means it can do all kinds of stuff that non-polar things don't do. degrees, 104.5 degrees. And you say, why those numbers? Well, there's some theories about why those numbers, but the fact is, class, if you didn't have those numbers, you'd be in a heap of trouble. You wouldn't be here. You change that 104.5 degrees very, very little, and you wouldn't be here. Because because it wouldn't be water. It is the only substance on earth that exists in all three states, solid, liquid, and gas. It has a uniquely high specific heat. I have to take just a minute on this. You want to be the same temperature almost all the time? Come to St. Pete, Florida. St. Pete is on a peninsula, Pinellas County. It's surrounded on three sides by water. And water, ladies and gentlemen, does not change temperature rapidly, period. That's why in the desert, temperatures change so rapidly. There's not much water out there. And sand changes temperature quickly. Water does not. That's specific heat. It takes a lot of energy put into water to make the temperature go up, and a lot of water extracted to make it go down. You with me? That's specific heat. When you do an experiment in chemistry lab and you compare the specific heats of substances, this is a measurable quantity. It's like this, and boom, there's water compared to everything else. There ain't no other thing like it. Pardon the English. We're going to spend about 2 weeks on that class. Come back tomorrow. It has a wide temperature range for liquid. You better thank the Lord for that. 0 to 100 degrees centigrade. Water is mostly liquid. In your blood, ladies and gentlemen, if you didn't have water as most of the liquid form of your blood, you'd be dead. It's less dense as a solid. That is absolutely out of whack. When things go from liquid to solid, they should get more dense, not water. Did you drink your tea tonight? Where was the solid water? At the top. Solid water is supposed to be on the bottom, not with water. You want to go study that? If that weren't the case, you'd be dead. And you say, why is that? Go look it up. It's the universal solvent. It almost dissolves everything. It has high surface tension, cohesion, and adhesion. Folks, it is the most amazing substance on the face of this earth and in this universe. And everybody knows that life is water-based. And there isn't any other form of life. So, Michael Behe, in his wonderful book, Darwin's Black Box, which, by the way, was published again 10 years later in 2006, that's the one you ought to get. And he says, the case is getting worse for the evolutionists the more we learn. He's a biochemist. And I'm going to focus on what he's learned and a bunch of others about chemistry tomorrow night. Don't you miss it. He says, everywhere we look, from the macroscopic, which we've been considering tonight, to the microscopic, things look like they are made. There's a loud, clear, piercing cry of design. And by the way, he has 2 exclamation points in the book. And he's right. So, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, is it reasonable in this scientific age to believe in God? I will tell you, it's more reasonable than it's ever been, and anybody that misses it is more without excuse than ever in the history of mankind. If they were without excuse when Romans 1 was written in the first century, there is absolutely no excuse in the 21st century. And that's my lesson for tonight. You were an A-plus audience. My experience has been through the years that sometimes the Q&A is the most fascinating part because it's what people really want to know about. And so we'll see what we can do with that tonight. And I almost hesitate to say this, but if you need to leave, you're welcome to leave. You don't have to stay for this. Like, you didn't have to come at all, but I'd like for you to stay for this if you would, but you don't have to. All right. Now, usually I take a minute to look at these. So this is chancy. All right. Here is a question that has almost nothing to do with the lesson tonight. And that's okay. I will tell you, though, that some of these questions I'm going to say you have to come back at another lesson, because I'm going to do a lesson on it, but not tonight. So I prefer to answer questions that relate to this subject and kind of generically tie with it. But do you take a position on the age of the earth? And do you think flexibility on this contentious issue, I guess, is allowed? Flexibility. Age question. Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Takes care of that one. And I really would prefer that you hear the discussion surrounding it to see where I am on it. And we are filming all of this. There's one right there. Hello. So you can get a copy of this later if you aren't able to come Sunday afternoon. All right. What is the story behind the photo? You know, the Earthrise? All right, I'll be very brief. I used to preach for a congregation in St. Pete, Florida, called Skyview Church. In fact, it's the first place I ever preached. My dad preached there, and he decided to leave and go with another congregation. They asked me to fill in till they got a full-time person. I was a full-time chemistry teacher. So I started preaching on the side. That was 1971, and I haven't stopped since. But in that congregation, there was a family of people, one of whom worked at Romo Labs. Romo Labs were the most famous photo lab, developing lab, in the probably the United States. So, all of you do know, don't you, that the space program is centered in my state? I mean, at least where that's where the rockets go off. Cape Canaveral, right? You need to go see it sometime. It's an amazing place. Cape Canaveral in the 1960s used Romo Labs to develop the film that had been taken in outer space. You remember what developing is, kids? So you take this film, it's in a roll, and you keep it in a dark place. There were what we call dark rooms. Anybody in here ever develop film? Some of you did, so you know. You can tell them even more. But they had to take the film in a dark room with certain kind of light, right? And you could undo it, and then you washed it in this chemical stuff, and it developed. I'll not go into detail, but you get a printed photograph out of that. As I told you earlier, the original print of Earthrise was shipped back to Cape Canaveral, and the astronauts were brought in. And they said, no, not good enough. In your process, you didn't make the Earth blue enough. It's way bluer than that. And so they sent it back. And when it got back to Romo Labs, the manager said, okay, we'll just rip that up and make another one. And the lady who was a member at Skyview said, well, may I have that? And he allowed it to have it, let her to have it. She wrapped it up in a piece of cloth and took it home. 40 years later, what year was that, class? 1968. In fact, it was into 69 by then. 40 years later, I'm preaching a meeting in which I use that picture, Earthrise, at Chiefland, Florida. And among the guests that night was this lady. She came up afterwards and said, I really enjoyed your speech. I'm going to bring you something tomorrow night. She brought me, wrapped up in that cloth, this picture. And I unrolled it, and it reminded me of von Tischendorf finding the ancient manuscript of the Bible. And I thought, where in the world did you get this? She said, not only am I giving it to you, I've got a notarized letter here saying how I got it and why I gave it to you. So, ladies and gentlemen, it was already deteriorating. I had that thing vacuum packed in a frame behind non-glare glass. Vacuum packed. That's expensive. You don't want air. And it's on my wall in my office if you want to come see it sometime. And it's a treasure to me. Somebody say, how much is that worth? I don't know, but it's to me it's worth a lot. That's how that happened. Probably too long. What if a proton moved 0.1 degree. May I say this? This is a good question. The proton moving is not a big issue because protons mostly are trapped in the nucleus. Y'all remember this? It's mostly trapped in the nucleus. It doesn't move much. It vibrates. So the motion of a protein is not as critical as some other things. But I would say to you, a proton moving 0.1 degree is nothing compared to what I'm saying up here. The better question would be, what if the proton moved 0.00000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000 talking about? On all of these features I described to you, a teensy change that hardly is measurable at all changes everything. So my answer to this question is a 0.1 degree change in the proton's direction or anything like that, that is way massively more. If that happened, we'd probably all be exploding. I don't know. All right. What is Mr. Behe's current belief concerning Genesis 1, 1 through 31, 6 days? I have not asked Mr. Behe that question. But I understand that Mr. Behe, by the way, he's a Roman Catholic, and that's not anything I'm revealing to you that isn't public knowledge. He's a Roman Catholic, and you should know that the Pope of the Catholic Church has pronounced his blessing upon the general theory of evolution. Are you aware of that? A Roman Catholic does not have to deny the general theory of evolution to remain a faithful Roman Catholic, because the Pope has blessed it. So how do they explain the man made in the image of God? Here's how a Roman Catholic theologian explains that. Somewhere in the process of man's evolution of his body, God chose to implant a spirit miraculously at some point in history. But the body evolved by natural causes, by the blind forces of physics acting upon natural selection. My point in telling you all that is Michael Behe had no reason religiously to start to question the general theory of evolution. He began to question it because of what he was observing in his biochemistry lab, which to him was so overwhelmingly in opposition to a natural cause that he had to write about it. And that's tomorrow night. I don't know what his position is on Genesis 1, 1 through 31, except to say he believes firmly in a creator. So you can ask him that question. How are viruses different from the evolutionary process, and why would we assume we are the only ones in the universe? Okay, that's two questions. Viruses. Is that a whole subject in itself? Did all of you know that viruses, to live, have to live inside animal or human tissue? You know that? That's why they're not nice things. And when they get inside your tissue, they basically take over your DNA and help your DNA make more viruses. But they couldn't do that without you. Or without animals. So viruses are a very interesting part of our nature. And I'm not a virologist. I certainly don't know all about them. But I do know there are some uses for viruses that seem to be beneficial. And there's some that aren't. I would say viruses are part of our fallen world. That's not a scientific explanation. But they are problematic in a lot of ways. As you know, this very day. So, how are they different from evolutionary process? An evolutionist would have to say that viruses are one of those results that came about by natural causes along this line of the tree of evolution that just happened as one of the possible things that could happen. That's how they would say that. It's a different strain of things. And is it really alive? It's a good question. It can't survive without living things. Why would we assume we're the only ones in the universe? Okay, here's how I would answer that. I don't want you to assume that, not from the scientific perspective. A scientist examines the evidence and then tries to draw the most reasonable conclusion. He doesn't start with the conclusion and try to prove it. Did you hear that? That's important. So if a scientist is looking at the subject, are we, when I mean that, as humans here on earth, the only living things like that in the universe? The question should be, what evidence is there that there are any others? Because we know we're here, right? And I already told you that we've been through years and years of people saying there are lots of other ones, maybe millions of other civilizations out there, but I can tell you that the thrust of the evidence is beginning to turn toward, no, the properties necessary for you and I to be here and function are so rare that we're probably the only ones around. That's the way science goes at it. So don't say, why would we assume? That's not the way science works. It's true that science has to assume some things. You got to assume the ability to reason, and you got to be able to take experiments, you know, and look at them and get results. But don't assume something as important as that, not from science. But I will tell you, without assuming it, there is a massive amount of evidence to support that there ain't anybody else. How does man determine the earth is billions of years old? That's another age question. Sunday afternoon. How did you get the pick of the earth and the moon? I just answered it. Okay, are there other questions? Yes. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am. I'll take an oral question if you would like. It's still a problem. Correct. I have no problem with that position. The problem with it scientifically is there's little or no evidence to support that there is another civilization. Did they think there was? Yeah, they did for a long time, and some still do. SETI is alive and well, by the way. They're still looking, and they're using private money to support their efforts. And we'll say a little more about that tomorrow night, too. Okay, well, I'm looking across this audience, and I've taught long enough to know you've had enough. The seat can only endure, right? I mean, the mind can only endure what the seat can endure. So, I appreciate your good attention tonight, and it's been very a blessing to me to be able to share this with you. And I hope you leave here this evening with something maybe you hadn't thought about before that broadens your view of the amazing God we serve. And I hope you won't miss the rest of it because there's so much more to this story. And I love telling it. And I love for folks who don't believe it to listen and at least take it in sufficiently to examine the evidence. All right. So what do we do from here? We're dismissed. All right. And we're allowed to shake hands.